Hello. Thanks everyone for joining us today. I'm Sarah Fender, and I lead product marketing for Azure in the area of security, privacy, and compliance.
Thanks. My name is Mark Perry. I'm part of our worldwide CTO team out of our specialist sales group, and I focus on Azure and Azure security.
So we've structured today's session to try to address some of the key questions that customers have when moving to the cloud, starting with, can the cloud be more secure, or at least as secure, as my on-premise environments? What technical and operational safeguards does Azure have in place? And what can I further do to add additional security on top of that for the data and applications and infrastructure that I'm running in Azure? Where's my data and who can access it? And finally, how do I meet my compliance obligations for workloads that I'm running in Azure? So let's jump right in and take a look at that first question. So can the cloud be more secure than on-premises? So CIOs are incredibly eager to realize the speed and scale and economic benefits of moving to the cloud. And according to IDC, 70% of CIOs will be adopting a cloud-first strategy by 2016. And what this means is they'll be considering cloud-based delivery as the preferred method for new services and technology investments. And so that means not just putting their public websites in the public cloud, but also moving core infrastructure, mission-critical applications, PII, and other regulated data to the cloud as well. But they're only going to do that if they're sure that the appropriate security is in place, that they're not going to put their data or their organization at increased risk as a result of moving to the cloud. So we partnered with Comscore recently on a survey. We looked at two different groups of customers, those that had not yet adopted the cloud and those that were actively running workloads in the cloud, and we asked them about their perceptions relative to cloud security. And what that first group said, those folks who had not yet moved to the cloud, they had a lot of concerns. 60% were concerned about data security, 45% thought that they'd lose control over their data in the cloud. But what's interesting is that group that had begun to leverage the cloud already had a very, very different view of security in the cloud. 94% said that they'd experienced security benefits they hadn't had on-premise, and 62% said that the privacy protections actually increased as a result of moving to the cloud. We believe that's largely driven by the breadth and depth of safeguards that Microsoft employs. So few individual organizations can really replicate the technology and operational processes that we have in place to safeguard our enterprise cloud services and to comply with a wide range of regulatory standards. That's built on this trustworthy foundation. Microsoft really has decades now of unmatched experience building enterprise software and running some of the largest cloud services in the world. Today, the Microsoft Cloud infrastructure supports over 1 billion customers, 200 million businesses, and operates in 76 markets worldwide, just ginormous scale. And Microsoft has leveraged this expertise to create and implement industry-leading software development practices, operational management policies, and threat mitigation practices. We'll take a look at some of these as we work through the presentation. Some other things I'll point out on the timeline, see the first Microsoft data center in 1989, things like the Trustworthy Computing Initiative, who developed that group developed the security development lifecycle. We'll look at that in a moment. There's a number of centers of excellence across the organization, the Microsoft Security Response Center, the Digital Crimes Unit, the Malware Protection Center, lots of dedicated resources across Microsoft that are looking at security and cyber threats. And we're able to leverage that information. We share that across our product and services groups. We have a lot of insight into the threat landscape, and we can use that to better defend against it. So if we dig in a little bit on the data center side of things. So today, Microsoft operates more than 1 million servers in more than 100 data centers in over 40 countries across the globe. Now, not all of those are running Azure, but just to sort of demonstrate the scale of our data center operations. These circles, these kind of light circles that you see, are the Microsoft network. And I didn't realize until recently that Microsoft operates one of the three largest networks in the world. So about 3 years ago, the size of the Microsoft network surpassed that of even the largest telco. So an amazing scale, both in terms of data center facilities and also the network to support those. So I mentioned the security development lifecycle that was developed by TWC. It just celebrated its 10-year anniversary, and it really informs the way that we design software, build software across all of Microsoft, but also has become an industry standard. So lots of external organizations also leverage this process to develop more secure, less vulnerable code. And so it includes a set of educational, there's kind of a training component to the security development lifecycle, their secure development processes, and accountability both at the individual level and amongst product teams. So the SDL provides a systematic way to address security threats throughout the development lifecycle. So this involves threat modeling during the design process, following development best practices, doing security code reviews, requiring the use of various tools for testing and verification. And these proactive checks during the development process really help us to develop software that has less vulnerabilities, and that consistent methodology really helps to drive that. So we talked about some of the different groups across Microsoft who are gathering threat intelligence and who we share information with to harden our own threat defense approach. One in particular I wanted to call out was the Digital Crimes Unit. Not as many folks may be familiar with this, but it's a group of lawyers and researchers. We partner with external organizations within our Digital Crimes Unit, and their mission is really threefold. They're looking at proactive malware disruption, intellectual property crimes, and privacy issues. And then this third, which really most folks don't understand or realize that we're doing a lot of work in, which is protecting consumers, particularly those in vulnerable populations, so children, the disabled, the elderly. So they're doing a lot of really cool work in the Digital Crimes Unit. And the reason I wanted to call them out in particular is because in addition to the other kind of resources, company-wide assets, that kind of accrue up to or sort of benefit, influence the way we operate and manage our service. This is one case where we're actually delivering some capabilities, surfacing these capabilities to our end users, and we do that through the Azure Active Directory. So we get a feed from the Digital Crimes Unit of malware-infected devices, and so when you're using Azure Active Directory, you can get a report of which of your users are signing in from those compromised devices. So this is just one really concrete example of how these company-wide resources really benefit our Azure customers. So Microsoft takes a two-pronged approach to threat defense, which they refer to as the prevent breach and assume breach. Prevent breach is kind of the defensive strategy that's aimed at predicting and preventing a security breach. Most of you are doing this today. It's kind of building continuous improvements into your applications, doing port scanning, vulnerability testing, making sure that your operating systems are patched, that you have the right network level DDoS protection and prevention in place, that you're using multi-factor authentication for users who are signing in. So we're doing all of this stuff at the platform level. But in addition to that, we've adopted an assume breach strategy as well. So we have teams, we call them, there's a red team and a blue team, and they're constantly testing the Azure service, simulating real-world attacks, thinking about things like if there was some kind of a breach, how far could that attacker reach within the network? And it helps us to do things like ensure we have the right separation of duties in place and that we have the right isolation, that if an attack were to happen, that we could respond very, very quickly to that and remediate and address the situation. So I think more organizations are moving toward this assume breach approach, but it's been something that we've had in place almost from the beginning of Azure and really informs the way that we do threat defense at the platform level. So So as you move from on-premises into the cloud, you have the opportunity to sort of benefit more directly from the Microsoft experience and expertise as it relates to security. So on-premises, you're responsible for the entire securing the entire technology stack, right? And as you move toward kind of adopt cloud services, infrastructure services, platform services, or more finished SaaS services, you begin to shift some of the responsibility to the cloud service provider. So Microsoft takes on some of the burden for securing pieces of the stack, and so infrastructure as a service, for example, you don't have to worry about physical security, which you would have to do otherwise. But you do still have to maintain responsibility for OS patching of your virtual machines running in the environment. And as you move up the kind of cloud computing stack, Microsoft takes on more of that burden for you. But it is a shared responsibility, which I think is really important to sort of understand. And we think about that in two ways, right? So we want to do the best job we can. We want to employ cutting-edge technologies to secure the pieces of the stack that we're managing on behalf of our customers. We also want to provide you with the tools and capabilities that you need to add the additional security controls for the data and applications that you're running on top of the platform. So it's kind of a combination of making sure we've got really good built-in security, and then we're also providing you with the tools and flexibility and capabilities that you need to secure the applications that you're running on top of the platform. And we don't expect our customers to just take our word for it. We're committed to ongoing independent verification by third parties. I think we have auditors in the Azure engineering and operations offices within our data centers virtually all of the time. Between ISO and a number of our other audits, just a really ongoing, rigorous set of third-party audits and assessments that we undergo on an ongoing basis. And we provide access to those audit reports to our customers. So, again, as you sort of are relying on us for more of the stack, we want to make sure that you have the appropriate level of insight into how we're managing those components so that you can be assured that the right security controls are in place. We can't allow all of our individual customers to audit our data centers and all of our processes. That would be incredibly onerous on everyone's part, but we provide access to those third-party audit reports so that you have detail about what was audited and can kind of get that level of confidence. And it also helps you to achieve compliance back to that shared responsibility model. So you can take that SOC report to your auditor in addition to certifying the pieces that you're running on top of Azure, the applications or data that you're running. So you kind of take the work that we've done and add it to the compliance work that you do to demonstrate compliance for applications and workloads running in Azure. As well as compliance packages. So that applies particularly FedRAMP, for example, in the U.S. is a package that our customers can take to their auditors to demonstrate compliance. So we do that also when possible. We provide lots of best practices and guidance, lots of documentation in the Azure Trust Center in particular. There's a best practices guide there that's 60-some-odd pages that talks about how to build and develop and deploy and manage secure workloads in the cloud. That in particular is a fantastic resource, but lots and lots of documentation there, and we're continuing to ramp that up again. I'm going to provide as much insight and into what we're doing and what you can and perhaps should be doing as you build and manage workloads there. Publish all of that in the Trust Center. Lots and lots of good information there on azure.microsoft.com. Participate in the Cloud Security Alliance and publish information to their STAR registry. And then Microsoft as a whole also publishes reports like the Security Response Center Progress Report and the Security Intelligence Report that just provide information to you about what we're seeing in terms of the threat landscape to help you kind of stay ahead of that. So one thing I wanted to mention before we move on, I should have done that. Back to this slide. So I'm going to hand it off to Mark in just a second. He's going to talk through in much more detail some of those security controls, so both what we're doing and what you can do with the platform, kind of back to this shared responsibility model. So as we walk through the security content be a bit of a focus on sort of Azure, what we're doing at the platform level, and then also what you're doing. You have to put the two together. And so I think it's helpful to, hopefully will help be helpful to you that we've structured it a bit that way. Okay.
Thanks, Sarah. So I'm going to dive right in. If we look at our physical data center, one of the questions that customers always ask me when I work with them is, you know, if I put my data in your data center, who in the data center has access to my data? That answer is nobody has access to your data from the data center. The data center folks only take care of the care and feeding of the servers. So they make sure that there's power. They make sure that the network's up. They make sure that the HVAC systems are running. They have no access to the Azure Fabric. Our data centers are very highly advanced. We're on our fifth generation of data center right now. If you come to, I guess for you guys, you'd likely come to Dublin or Amsterdam to do a data center tour. If you have any interest, I'd highly recommend it because it's just amazing to see where I live in Redmond, the Quincy data center. It's almost like a going to see a history lesson because you can see generation 2 through 5 and you see these rooms that have, you know, massive diesel engines that take up as much space as we have in this room to, if you look at generation 5, they're, you know, pods that are sitting out in a wired fence, but, you know, there's a, just the technology has advanced so much. One of the things that we do have, obviously, is, you know, multi-factor authentication to get in the building. If you go on the tour, we have to get an NDA and, you know, photo ID ahead of time, so it's a highly secure environment. Now, if we look at the Azure of architecture of Azure, it's based on Windows Server, obviously, but it's a heavily stripped down version of Windows Server. Only devices and drivers that are required to run the fabric are deployed, so that way the attack surface is very, very small. If you look at the way that it's designed, there's this concept called the fabric controller. You can think of the fabric controller as the kernel for Windows Azure. There are three separate networks inside of Azure. There's the fabric controller, which is the kernel. There's also storage, which is where your data is going to reside. And there's also compute, which is where your virtual machines and instances are going to run. The only component out of Azure that can actually reach across all three of those is the fabric controller. So if we look at patch management, this is something that we obviously take to the host environment. One of the things that we've worked on is being able to patch data centers in a very timely fashion. Because we have over 1 million servers under management, being able to patch quickly and intelligently is something that we've worked hard on doing. We can patch an entire data center in roughly about 30 minutes. One of the nice things about, if you look at our host environment, we have a very limited number of deployments of OSs deployed. So if you think about your typical IT data center, you might have multiple different versions of OSs and builds on different versions of those OSs. We have a very limited number, so we have much less to manage there. One thing that you as a customer has to do, you have to patch your IaaS VMs. So if you're using a PaaS service, that's something where we maintain the patching for the whole service. You can actually, if there's a patch that's deployed, you can actually decide when to apply it to your environment. But if you're running virtual machines, we'll take care of the host environment, but your virtual machine, you're still going to need to patch those. And you can use, you know, the same tools that you would use on-premise, so the System Center suite or otherwise. Now, if we look at monitoring and logging, we obviously monitor and log for the entire platform environment. We do not monitor and log what happens inside of your actual VMs. So that's a place where you will still need to have some sort of tool set, so SCCM, SCOM, those types of tools to monitor and log for inside of your virtual machines. We monitor and log for both information and security events across the entire platform. If there was ever a security incident that you noticed, we'd obviously work with you and collect the data that's pertinent to you so you can share that for forensic analysis. And as far as what you collect and where you place it, if you wanted to do big data analytics, you could place it into HD Insight. We actually, if you look at our internal systems, it's similar to that. You can log it to SQL. If you have a security incident event monitoring system, you could send the notices directly to there as well. Now, if we look at antivirus and anti-malware, this is obviously something that we have deployed on the host environment. If you're running virtual machines, it's something that you'll need to deploy in your virtual machines. We have multiple options available inside of the portal to inject those agents into your VMs directly at creation time. So we've got Trend, Symantec, McAfee, and obviously our own. Now, if we look at threat defense, this is something that customers will ask me about. And the question that typically comes up is, if I put my VMs or my environment into Azure, is it magically secure or more secure? And the answer is sometimes. The controls that we have in place are really geared towards protecting the platform. So if you think of things that could degrade service or degrade SLAs, those are things that we look for. If it's something that is going to be targeted specifically at your application running in the cloud, that may be a low-rate DDoS attack, those are not going to be things that we necessarily look for. So I have a couple stories. So one of the stories is around a US-based customer. They do a lot of processing for businesses, financial services. They were under a DDoS attack. They were, the Secret Services was engaged. They were getting ransom notes. Over a long weekend, we moved their entire environment to Azure. We didn't change a bit of the code. We just did a lift and shift. Now, because of the type of attack that they were getting, it was a high-rate DDoS attack. Our platform completely remediated that attack because it would have degraded the service of the platform. Now, on a flip side, we're working with a Latin American government. They were hosting their election results on Azure. So you can imagine that's a great place for somebody is going to want to try and bring that site down. It was a low-rate DDoS attack. It was really geared specifically at the application. It got by our systems because it wouldn't have degraded the service. Now, one of the things that took place is because they opened a ticket with Microsoft, we got security engineering engaged immediately. We looked at their environment because they asked us to do so, and we gave them recommendations on how to change the firewall settings and to change the setup of their deployment to stop that attack. We also took some of our focus tools that if we notice a breach or notice something that looks like a breach, we have tools that we can pinpoint on those. We pinpointed it on theirs to give them extra some extra care because they had a window of 2 weeks where the election was going to take place, so it needed to be up after two, and after 2 weeks it wasn't going to be around anymore. But those are a couple different examples. Now, if we look at network isolation, so your virtual networks, it's software-defined networking, so your networks are completely isolated from other tenants. When you deploy a virtual network and put your VMs into that network, it's completely restricted from accessing any other parts of the Azure environment. Requests can't come in. You have to physically open up those ports to have communication back and forth. The only thing that you'd be able to get to is that RDP endpoint, so you can actually RDP into those VMs. So if we look at what virtual networks are inside of Windows Azure, you can make as many subnets as you want. You can use your own DNS. You can even domain join those virtual machines, so that way it looks like a physical part of your own network. We also have some other VPN type of options that I'll get into in a minute. But as far as how complex or simple you want to make your networking environment look like inside of Azure, you can model it after your own data center if you'd like, or create something totally custom. So if we look at some of the new features that have come out at this TechEd, network security groups is one of them. One of the great things about network security groups is that it gives you the ability to create fine-grained security controls over either individual VMs or entire subnets. This kind of feature gives you the ability to create a true DMZ type of environment inside of Azure. So if we look at VPN connections, there's a couple of off-the-shelf VPN connections. There's point-to-site and site-to-site. So if you think of point-to-site, point-to-site is going to be like the VPN that you use on your desktop at work. So if you're on your laptop and you're launching a VPN to connect to your network at work, that's what a point-to-site VPN is like. So it gives you a single connection. Now, a site-to-site is typically what's going to be deployed for a data center type of connectivity, and one of the nice things is it will work with a multitude of different VPN vendors, so Cisco, Juniper, and the like. You'll obviously have an encrypted channel to communicate back and forth. Now, if we look at some other options, ExpressRoute is another option. So this is a dedicated fiber channel from your data center or a peering partner into Windows, into Microsoft Azure. The benefit here is that you have extremely low latency connectivity. Also, this does not traverse the public internet, so you can truly have a data center extension that doesn't even connect to the public internet. So around identity and access management, one of the recommended deployment options we have for Azure is to use your Azure Active Directory. So Azure Active Directory gives you the ability to use your domain credentials to log in to all of your Azure tenants and Azure services. It also provides you the ability to have SSO into literally thousands of SaaS applications, so Dropbox, Concur, Salesforce. One of the other nice things for security conscious folks is that it also gives you security and monitoring, so you can see, when your users are logging in, where they're logging in from, if there's particular scenarios that you want to either deny access or require multi-factor authentication. So if they're coming from restricted IP addresses, certain devices, from an unknown geo, you can require multi-factor authentication. One of the other things that's also interesting with that is just in preview, we have a cloud app Explorer. So that's an agent that you can deploy to your users internally that'll also actually tell you what SaaS apps they're using if you wanted to get in front of this. There we go. And this is kind of a little picture of the multi-factor. So if they're coming from a unknown location or restricted IP address, you can go through the multi-factor authentication. So that's either a text message, phone call, or app running on your phone. So if you look at encryption in transit, data that transfers between our data centers or between our data centers in the same geo or across different geos, that's encrypted. We use HTTPS for authentication into the portal. If you look at the fabric controller that I was talking before, the fabric controller makes an SSL handshake with the hosts to before it communicates. Now, if we look at what customers can do, obviously we recommend putting using HTTPS, also using SSL in between your VMs and your subnets. Now, encryption at rest, there's a lot of different options here. You can use things like BitLocker on boot drives. You can use TDE for SQL. You can use encrypted file system for files and folders. We also have some partners solutions here that have been very popular. So Trend Micro has a secure cloud solution that I've had several customers use. And CloudLink also has a solution. The benefits of those types of solutions are that the encryption keys for the data reside outside of Azure. So if you're concerned about Microsoft having access to your data or some other third party having access to your data, your encryption keys are not stored inside of Azure with your data. They're stored outside of it. Now, if we look at some other options, if you look at some of our device offerings like Store Simple, which can be used for backup and replication to the cloud, it encrypts data on upload, so it keeps the keys on premise. And then obviously on the application side, if you're writing a PaaS app, we have a crypto API, so you can encrypt data that way as well. So as far as data segregation goes, the data is completely segregated on the back end. You use storage account keys and shared access signatures to access that data from within your apps. You can have rolling key rollover as well. Those are the ways that your applications are going to access those storage accounts. And then if we look at network isolation, we've talked about that a little bit. You're logically separated from all other tenants. And then obviously the SQL database, so our SQL Azure has separate accounts as well. Now if we look at incident response, this is something that customers typically have questions around, and it's because in their own environment they know how incident response is handled, and once you move to a cloud service, you're putting some of that control into your service provider. We have a very detailed nine-step process for incident response from when an incident is either recognized or a customer phones in. One of the things that we really focus on is around containment and recovery. But we have a very detailed process. One of the nice things is that we will share forensic information with you along the way. Based on the engagements that we get, we also will go in and look at your tenant if you ask us to give you recommendations on how to rectify the situation as well as recover. So one of the areas that I think we're really, really growing is around security partners. There's a ton of great security partners that I work with daily. Barracuda Networks has some awesome solutions around web application firewalls and next generation firewalls. We also have folks like Trend and CloudLink that offer those encryption type of options. And then AlertLogic offers solutions like security as a service, and then several of the other ones are antivirus vendors. But there's a multitude of partner offerings that you can leverage, and a lot of the ones that are up there are ones that our customers are also using on premise, so it gives you some comfort as well. I'm going to hand it back over to Sarah.
Thank you. So moving on, where is my data and who can access it? I know that's a particularly, not that we don't get that question everywhere, but particularly in Europe. I know there are some questions around this. And data location is an increasingly important part of data privacy and protection. So customers in Azure can choose where their data resides. So you choose the region. Where your data lives, and within that region, we make three copies for redundancy purposes. You can also have that data replicated to another region hundreds of miles away, but still within the same geopolitical region. We call that a geo. So if you want your data to be in the EU only, we can replicate across our two European data centers, and we commit to not transferring your data outside of that geo that you've placed your data in. Microsoft personnel have no standing access to your data. We will, on occasion, need to access your data in order to provide support or to help you troubleshoot a service. And when we do, there's a rigorous process that kicks in. Leadership approval is required. Access is logged for auditing purposes. The multi-factor authentication is required. We only give the least amount of access that we can for the least amount of time. So just enough time to get in there and do what we need to do to help support you, our customer, and then that access is terminated. When you delete data, for example, if you delete data in storage, the index that provides access to that data is immediately removed from the primary location and also from the geo-replicated copy. And customers are only able to read from disk space that they've written to. So they can never read from another customer's disk space as a result. Wiping is done according to NIST compliance standards, and defective disks are destroyed at the data center. So Azure is a little bit unique among cloud service providers in that we have a privacy policy specific to our enterprise cloud services. A number of other vendors have one privacy policy that applies to their consumer offerings as well as their enterprise or business offerings. We don't mingle the two, and we never share the data of our enterprise customers with our advertiser-supported services. We don't mine customer data for advertising purposes. We do not do that, and we make commitments relative to that in our privacy policies. We also make strong contractual commitments. In particular, for our European customers, we offer EU model clauses that help to address the EU privacy requirements. And we recently received endorsement by the Article 29. So this is a group of data protection authorities in the European Union that they reviewed all of our contracts and commitments relative to data privacy and found that they do, in fact, meet the high bar for data privacy standards in the European Union. So we were the first and so far the only company to obtain that Article 29 letter. And so we're pretty proud of the work that we've done there to help ensure that our European customers can meet their privacy obligations. We do a number of other things in terms of contractual commitments relative to privacy for customers that are subject to U.S. HIPAA requirements. That's relative to healthcare data. We offer a business associate agreement. We have data processing agreement, which is now built into our standard online services terms. So it used to be a separate contractual addendum that you had to sign, and we really wanted to make sure that those contractual commitments were just built in so all of our customers would get them by default. And so that's what we've done in pulling that data processing agreement into our standard online services terms. Now, this is a particular interest, and it's not part of my standard talk track, but I knew that you would ask, so I wanted to spend just a couple of minutes talking about government access. So Microsoft as an organization has a very clear approach to dealing with government access. We do not provide any government with direct or unfettered access to your data. We don't help governments break our encryption or provide them with encryption keys that they could use to access your data either in transit or at rest. We don't engineer backdoors into our products, and we take steps to ensure that governments can independently verify this. So we have transparency centers that are available. If governments want to review, do code review, we support that. Just finally, if, as the press suggests, governments are engaging in broader surveillance, Microsoft is, they're doing that without the knowledge or involvement of Microsoft. We do occasionally receive legal requests for customer data. Mostly this happens for our consumer services, things like Hotmail. But we have a very clear approach here as well. We do not disclose customer data. Unless you tell us to or we're required to by law, but we get a legal request for data. The first thing we do is try to redirect that request back to the customer. We don't want to be in charge of brokering your data. It's not our job. We don't want to be involved in that process. So if someone wants your data, we tell them to go get it from you directly. If we are legally obligated to provide data, we notify the customer. If we're not legally permitted to notify the customer, we've made a commitment to challenge those legal requests in court. So doing as much as we can to ensure that the legal requests for data are handled with as much transparency as possible. We do publish this law enforcement request report, again, to provide more information to you about the kinds of requests that we get, and that provides more detail in terms of what consumer enterprise services. So if you're interested, that's something I encourage you to take a look at. And then we're taking a number of additional steps to ensure the privacy and security of our customers' data. Talked a little bit about transparency. So we're trying to publish as much information as we can about what kinds of requests we get and the impact of those demands. We're advocating for reform and government surveillance. We really think there should be some clear rules and more transparency and more oversight. We talked a bit about the transparency centers. That's this item on the far right. So providing access to governments to do code reviews. Working for a new global legal framework relative to government surveillance, and also doing some things on the technology side. So we've made a number of commitments. Microsoft's general counsel did earlier, December, around strengthening our encryption. And in Azure, we released some additional encryption capabilities supporting perfect forward secrecy for encryption in transit, and continue to build out the set of encryption capabilities, allowing you to implement a range of options, and if you want, to manage and control your own keys. And then from a legal perspective, fighting for our customers' legal rights in the courts, and we've made, again, just a really strong commitment to take that as high up into the U.S. court system as possible to ensure that the appropriate legal that the appropriate laws are in place and being executed. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation recently released, they have an annual report that's called Who Has Your Back? It's a report on data on cloud service providers and what they're doing in terms of responding to government requests for data. Very, very, very pleased to say that Microsoft received 6 out of 6 stars from the EFF, and a number of our competitors in the cloud services space did not. So very proud to see this endorsement and sort of recognition of the commitments that we've made. And then finally, we're going to end with, how do I meet my compliance obligations in Azure? So we talked a little bit about compliance earlier, but Azure manages compliance against a broad range of both international and industry and country-specific requirements. Fundamentally, that sort of starts with the ISO 27001, includes SOC 1 Type 2 as well as SOC 2 Type 2. We make those reports available. And then kind of a laundry list of other acronyms, everything from FedRAMP in the U.S., Payment Card Industry Data Security Standards. In the U.K., we recently received gCloud Official. Before we were IL2, so there's a new definition there, and also an expanded scope of services that are covered as part of that certification. Talked about HIPAA. We just announced the Australia IRAP. It's an Australian government certification, and then we published some information about how to comply with life sciences compliance requirements. So compliance, managing compliance across all of the Azure services is it's an interesting challenge. And so we've really tried to build some processes around that, an approach that's going to scale. We are releasing new capabilities. You saw the keynote the other day, just an incredibly rapid pace. Every 3 weeks, there are new features and capabilities coming out of Azure. And so we really need a process that allows us to quickly onboard those services into our compliance programs and also to quickly respond to changes in the regulatory landscape. So we have hundreds of controls that govern how Microsoft manages the Azure environment, and we map those against these industry standards, and that allows us to be more agile in terms of onboarding new services and responding to new regulatory or changes in the regulatory landscape. Lovely little animated slide. So at the end of the day, we're committed to enhancing security and protecting privacy and simplifying compliance. And we've hopefully addressed the core questions here today. Can the cloud be as secure, more secure? What technical operational safeguards are in place on the Azure platform side? What you can do to further ensure the security of the data and applications and infrastructure running on the platform? Where your data lives and who can access it? And how you can meet your compliance obligations in Azure. So we'd like to open it up. Well, do one. There are some other sessions I wanted to point out. One is the data protection in Azure story that talks quite a bit more about encryption. It was yesterday, but you're able to access those recorded sessions after the event. So that might be a good one if you didn't catch that yesterday to go back and take another look at. Lots of new networking capabilities, so the networking session would be a good one, and also the session from TWC. And Mark and I will be at Ask the Experts tonight, so if you have any other questions, that's a good venue as well. So with that, we'll open it up for questions. There is a microphone in the front, and then I think we've also got a couple of people with walking microphones, so if you could just flag them down or step up to the mic, we'll take questions.
Hello. I saw this on the slide, but you did not mention it, but Microsoft performs pen testing on the cloud. What is the scope of this pen testing, and where do you stop?
So we pen test the platform. We have, that's part of the red team and blue teaming. It used to be something that we would hire a third-party auditor to do, but because of the way that we've added more resources and reorganized our internal security teams, it's something that we do continuously. We don't pen test your application. We pen test at the platform layer. One thing that I do recommend, and I didn't mention it in the talk track, was that customers can pen test their own tenants, their own applications. It's something that you can request via the Azure portal. So that's something that I'd recommend if you're, you know, curious about your own applications, you can pen test your apps.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay.
Thanks for coming.
Appreciate it. I think they're... Please complete your evaluation form.